Roxy. She says, I recognised your face as soon as I saw you. Seen you on the telly, haven't I? He thinks he's in a dream. Must be. Can't not be. He starts to cry, like a child confused and angry. She says, stop that now. You'll set me off. What the fuck are you doing here anyway? He tries to tell her, but the story no longer makes sense even to him. He decided to walk into danger because he thought he was enough, and now he is in danger, and it is clear to him that he has never been enough, and it is unbearable.
I was looking for the mountain colt,
he barks out at last. His throat is dry, and his head aches. She laughs.
Yeah, well, you found it. So that was a bloody stupid idea, wasn't it?
She gestures around her. He's at the edge of a small encampment. There are perhaps 40 dirty tents and huts slumped around the central fire. A few women are at the open mouths of their huts, wetting knives or fixing metal shot gauntlets or staring blankly. The place stinks. A smell of burning flesh and rotten food and feces and dogs and a sour note of vomit. To one side of the latrine, there's a pile of bones. Tunde hopes they are animal bones. There are two sad-looking dogs tied by short lengths of rope to a tree. One has an eye missing and patches of fur. He says,
You have to help me. Please, please help me.
She looks at him, and her face twists into an awkward half-smile. She shrugs, and he sees that she's drunk.
Fuck. I don't know what I can do, mate. I don't have much influence here. Fuck.
He's going to have to be more charming than he's ever been in his whole life. And he's stuck in a cage where he can't even move his neck. He takes a deep breath. He can do it. He can.
What are you doing here? You vanished the night of the big Moskalev party. And that was months ago. Even when I left the city, they were saying you'd been bumped off.
Roxy laughs.
Were they now? Were they? Well, someone tried, and it's taken me a while to heal is all. You look pretty healed now.
He looks her up and down appreciatively. He's particularly impressed with himself for doing so without being able to move. She laughs.
I was going to be president of this fucking country, you know, for about 3 hours there. I was going to be the fucking president. Yeah, he says. I was going to be the star of Amazon's fall lineup.
He looks right and left.
Think they're coming for me now with a drone?
And then she's laughing. And he's laughing too. The women at the entrances to the tents glance over at them balefully.
Seriously, what are they going to do with me?
He says.
Ah, these people are bloody mental. They hunt men at night, says Roxy. Send girls off into the forest to scare them. Once they're scared and running, they set a trap. Tripwire, something like that.
They haunted me.
Well, you bloody walked towards them, didn't you?
Roxy makes another little half-smile.
They got some thing about blokes. They round up boys and let them be king for a few weeks, then stick antlers on their heads and kill them at new moon. Or a full moon, or one of those moons, obsessed by the fucking moon. If you ask me, it's because they got no telly.
He laughs again. A real laugh. She's funny. This is the magic by daylight. Tricks and cruelty. The magic is in the belief in magic. All this is people with an insane idea. The only horror in it is imagining oneself into their minds, and that their insanity might have some consequences on the body. Listen, he says,
now we're here. How hard would it be for you to get me out?
He gives the door of his cage a little push with his feet. It is bound fast by several twine cords. It would not be hard for Roxy to cut them if she had a knife, but the people around the encampment would see. She pulls a flask out of her back pocket and takes a little swig, shakes her head.
They know me, she says, but I don't bother them. They don't bother me. So, you've been hiding in the wood for weeks, not bothering them? Yeah, she says. A fragment of something he read a long time ago floats through his mind. A flattering looking glass. He has to be a flattering mirror for her, reflecting her at twice her ordinary size, making her seem to herself to be strong enough to do this thing he needs her to do. Without that power, mutters a voice in his head, probably the earth would still be swamp and jungle. That's not you, he says. That's not who you are. I'm not who I was, my friend. You can't stop being who you are. You're Roxy Monk, she snorts. You want me to fight our way out of here? Because that's not going to happen. He gives a little laugh, like she's trying it on. Must be making a joke. You don't need to fight. You're Roxy Monk. You've got power to burn. I've seen you. I've heard about you. I've always wanted to meet you. You're the strongest woman anyone's ever seen. I've read the reports. You killed your father's rival in London and then put him out to pasture himself. You can just ask them for me, and they'll open the door. She shakes her head. You've got to have something to offer, something to trade. But she's thinking it through now. He can see it. What have you got that they want? He says. Her fingers dig into the wet earth. She holds two handfuls of soil for a moment, looking at him. I told myself I'd keep my head down, she says. He says, but that's not you. I've read about you. He hesitates, then chances his luck. I think you'll help me, because it's nothing to you to do it. Please. Because you're Roxy Monk. She swallows. She says, yeah. Yeah, I am. At dusk, more of the women return to the camp, and Roxanne Monk bargains with the blind woman for Tunde's life. As she speaks, Tunde sees that he was right. The people in this camp seem respectful and a little frightened of her. She has a small plastic bag of drugs that she dangles in front of the leaders of the camp. She asks for something, but is turned down. She shrugs. She gestures her head towards him. Fine, she seems to be saying. If we can't make a deal this way, I'll take that boy instead. The women are surprised, then suspicious. Really? That one? It's not a trick. There is a little haggling. The blind woman tries to argue. Roxy argues back. In the end, it doesn't take too much to persuade them to let him go. He was right about how they see Roxy, and he is not particularly prized. If this woman wants him, let her take him. The soldiers are coming anyway. The war is closer every day. These people are not mad enough to want to stay here now that the soldiers are close by. They'll take up their encampment in 2 or 3 days and move towards the mountains. They bind his arms tightly behind his back. They throw in the bag he was carrying for nothing, just to show her some respect. Don't be too friendly with me, she says as she pushes him to walk ahead of her. I want them to think I like you or that I got you cheap. His legs are cramped from his time in the cage. He has to take slow, shuffling steps along the forest path. It is an age until they are out of sight of the camp, and another eon until they cannot hear the noise of it behind them. With each step, he thinks, I am tied, and I am in the hands of Roxanne Monk. He thinks, she's a dangerous woman at the best of times. What if she's just playing with me? Once these thoughts have flashed across the mind, they can never be put back. He is silent until a few miles along the dirt track, she says, I think that's far enough, and takes a small knife from her pocket and cuts his bonds. He says, what are you going to do with me? She says, I suppose I'll rescue you, get you home. I'm Roxy Monk, after all. Then she breaks into a laugh. Anyway, you're a celebrity. People would pay good money for this, wouldn't they? walk through the forest with a celeb. And this makes him laugh. And his laughter makes her laugh. And then they are both standing in the forest, leaning against a tree, hooting and gasping for breath. And something is broken between them then. And something is a little easier. "Where are we heading?" he says. She shrugs. "I've been lying low for a bit. Something's rotten with my people. Someone betrayed me. I'm all right if they think I'm dead. Till I can work out how to get back what's mine." "You've been hiding," he says, "in a war zone? Isn't that a bloody stupid idea?" She looks at him sharply. He's chancing something here. He can already feel the prickles across his shoulder where she'd jolt him if he pissed her off. He might be a celebrity, but she's a mugshot. She kicks at the stone leaf mix on the path and says, "Yeah, probably. I didn't have much option, though. No nice compound in South America to jet off to. I thought you people had it all worked out." He does have to know how angry he can make her. This is clear right through to his bones. If she's going to try to hurt him, he needs to know that first. He's tensed for the blow already. But it does not come. She sticks her hands in her pockets. "I'm all right here," she says. "People keep their mouths shut. I'd left stuff for myself just in case, you know." He thinks of the little plastic packet she held in front of the women in the camp. Yes, if you're using an unstable regime to smuggle drugs, you probably do have any number of secret supply dumps, just in case of trouble. "Here," she says, "you're not going to write about this, are you?" "Depends whether I get out alive," he says. And that makes her laugh. And then he's laughing again. And after a minute, she says, "It's my brother, Daryl. He's got something of mine, and I'm going to have to be careful how I get it back off him. I'll get you home, but until I work out what to do, we're lying low. Okay?" "And that means we're going to spend a few nights in a refugee camp." They come to a tented muddy field at the bottom of a gully. Roxy goes to claim a space for them. "Just a few days," she says. "Make yourself useful. Meet people. Get to know them. Ask what they want." At the bottom of his rucksack, he finds an ID card from an Italian news gathering service, a year out of date, but enough to encourage some people to talk. He uses it judiciously, wandering from tent to tent. He learns that there has been more fighting than he'd heard, and more recently, that in the past 3 weeks, the helicopters don't even land anymore. They drop food and medicine and clothes and more tents for the slow and steady stream of stumbling people arriving through the woods. UNESCO is, understandably, unwilling to risk its people here. Roxy is treated respectfully here. She is a person who knows how to get certain drugs and fuel. She helps people with the things they need, and because he's with her, because he sleeps on a metal bed in her tent, the people here leave him alone. He feels a little safe, for the first time in weeks. But of course, he is not safe. Unlike Roxy, he could not simply walk into the forest in this place. Even if no other forest cult caught him, he is illegal now. He interviews a few English-speaking people in the camp who tell him the same thing over and over again. They are rounding up the men without papers. They go away for work detail, but they do not return. Some of the men here and some of the women tell the same story. There have been editorials in the newspapers and thoughtful-to-camera pieces on the one working black-and-white TV in the hospital tent. The subject is, how many men do we really need? Think it over, they say. Men are dangerous. Men commit the great majority of crimes. Men are less intelligent, less diligent, less hard-working. Their brains are in their muscles and their pricks. Men are more likely to suffer from diseases, and they are a drain on the resources of the country. Of course we need them to have babies, but how many do we need for that? Not as many as women. Good, Clean, obedient men, of course there will always be a place for those. But how many is that? Maybe 1 in 10? You can't be serious, Kristen. Is that really what they're saying? I'm afraid it is, Matt. She puts a gentle hand on his knee. And of course they're not talking about great guys like you. But that is the message of some extremist websites. That's why the North Star girls need more authority. We've got to protect ourselves against these people. Matt nods, his face somber. I blame those men's rights people. They're so extreme, they've provoked this kind of response. But now we have to protect ourselves. He breaks into a smile. And after the break, I'll be learning some fun self-defense moves you can practice at home. But first, the weather on the ones. Even here, even after all Tunde has seen, he can't really believe that this country is trying to kill most of its men. But he knows that these things have happened before. These things are always happening. The list of crimes punishable by death has grown longer. A newspaper announcement from a week-old paper suggests that surly refusal to obey on 3 separate occasions will now be punishable by work detail. There are women here in the camp, caring for 8 or 10 men who all huddle around her, vying for her approval, desperate to please, terrified of what might happen if she removed her name from their papers. Roxy could leave the camp at any time, but Tunde is alone here. On their 3rd night in the camp, Roxy wakes a few moments before the first tang and crackle of the power blows the lamps strung along the central pathway of the camp. She must have heard something, or just felt it. The way the nylon is humming, the power in the air. She opens her eyes and blinks. The old instincts are still strung in her. She has not lost them, at least. She kicks Tunde's metal frame bed. Wake up! He's tangled half in and half out of the sleeping bag. He pushes the cover off him, and he's almost naked there. Distracting, even now. What? He says, then hopefully, helicopter? Don't you wish, she says. Someone's attacking us. And then he's wide awake, pulling on his jeans and fleece. There's the smashing sound of glass and metal. Stay low to the ground, she says, and if you can, run into the woods and climb a tree. And then someone puts her hand to the central generator and summons all the power that is in her body and sends it hurtling through the machine, and the low lights burst into sparks and glass filaments all around the camp, and the darkness becomes absolute. Roxy hauls up the back of the tent, where it always leaked anyway, through the rotten stitching, and Tunde bellies out, starts for the forest. She should follow him. She will, in a moment. But she pulls on a dark jacket with a deep hood, wraps a scarf around her face. She'll keep to the shadows, work her way around to the north. That'll be the safest route out, anyway. She wants to see what's going on, as if she could still turn anything to her will. Around her, there are already screams and shouts. She's lucky that her tent wasn't on the edge of the camp. Some are burning there already, probably with people still inside, and there's the sweet stench of petrol. It will be several minutes yet until everyone in this camp even knows what's happening, and that it is not an accident or a generator fire. Through the tents, by the red glow of the fire, she glimpses a short, squat woman, setting aflame with the spark from her hands. The flash lights her face white for an instant. Roxy knows the look on her face. She's seen it before. The kind of face her dad would have said was a bad bet for business. Never keep someone on a job who likes it too much. She knows when she sees the single flash of that gleeful and hungry face that they're not here to raid for what they can find. They're not here for anything that can be given. They start by rounding up the young men. They go tent to tent, pulling them down or setting them on fire so the occupants have to run out or burn. They're not neat about it, not methodical. They're looking for any halfway decent-looking young men. She was right to send Tunde into the forest. A wife, or perhaps a sister, tries to stop them from taking the pale-skinned, curly-haired man who's with her. She fights off two of them with precise and well-timed jolts to the chin and the temple. They overwhelm her easily and kill her with a particular brutality. One of them grabs the woman by the hair, and the other delivers a bolt directly through the woman's eyes, finger and thumb pressed against her eyeballs, the very liquid of them scrambled to a milky white. Even Roxy has to look away for a moment. She backs further into the forest, climbs a tree hand over hand, using a loop of rope to help her. By the time she's found a crisscross place where three branches meet, they have turned their attention to the man. He will not stop screaming. Two of the women take him by the throat and send a paralysis into his spine. One squats on top of him. She pulls off his trousers. He is not unconscious. His eyes are wide and glistening. He is struggling for breath. Another of the men tries to rush forward to help him and gets a crack to the temple for his trouble. The woman on top cups his balls and dick in her palm. She says something, laughs. The others laugh too. She tickles him there with the tip of a finger, makes a little crooning sound, as if she wants him to enjoy it. He can't speak. His throat is bulging. They might have broken his windpipe already. She puts her head to one side, makes a sad face at him. She might as well have said in any language in the world, "What's the matter? Can't get it up." He tries to kick with his heels to get away from her, but it's too late for that. Roxy would like very much for this not to be happening. If she had it in her power, she would jump down from her concealed position and kill them. First these two by the tree. You could get those before anyone knew what you'd done. Then the three with knives would come for you, but you could dart to the left between the two oaks, so they'd have to come one by one. Then you'd have a knife. It would be easy. But that's not her position right now. And it is happening. No wishing on her part can stop it. Therefore, she watches to be a witness. The woman sitting on the man's chest applies her palm to his genitals. She starts with a low hum of a spark. He's still doing muffled screaming, trying to get away. It can't hurt too much yet. Roxy's done this herself to blokes, for both their fun. His cock comes up like a salute. They always do. Like a traitor. Like a fool. The woman makes a little smile appear across her face, raises her eyebrows, as if to say, "See? Just needed some encouragement, didn't you?" She holds his balls, tugs on them once, twice, just as if she were giving him a treat, and then jolts him fiercely right through the scrotum. It'd feel like a glass spike driven straight through, like lacerations from the inside. He screams and arches his back, and then she unbuttons the crotch of her combat trousers and sits on his cock. Her mates are laughing now, and she's laughing too as she pumps herself up and down on him. She's got her hand firmly planted in the centre of his stomach, giving him a dose every time she thrusts up with bunched thighs. One of her mates has a cell phone. They photograph her there, straddling him. He throws his arm over his face, but they pull the arm back. No, no, they want to remember this. Her mates are egging her on. She starts to touch herself, moves faster, her hips rocking forward. She's really hurting him now, not in a measured and thoughtful way, not to extract the maximum pain in interesting ways, just brutally. It's easily done as you get close. Roxy's done it herself once or twice. Scared some bloke. It'd be worse if you'd taken the glitter. The woman's got one hand on his chest, and every time she tips forward, she gives him a crackle across his torso. He's trying to push her hand away, and screaming and reaching out to the crowd around them for help, and begging in a slurred language Roxy wouldn't understand, except that the sound of "Help me, oh God, help me!" is the same in every language. When the woman comes, her mates roar their approval. She throws her head back and pushes her chest forward and lets go a huge blast right into the centre of his body. She rises, smiling, and they all pat her on the back, and she's laughing and smiling still. She shakes herself like a dog, and like a dog looks hungry yet. They start up a chant, the same four or five words in a rhythm as they ruffle her hair and give each other fist bumps.
The pale, curly-haired man had been stopped finally, and forever, by that last blast. His eyes are open, staring. The rivulets and streams of red scarring run across his chest and up around his throat. His prick is going to take a while to subside, but the rest of him is gone. Not even death throes. Not even twitching. The blood is even now pooling in his back, in his buttocks, in his heels. She'd put her hand on his heart and stopped him, dead. There is a noise that is different to grief. Sadness wails and cries out and lets loose a sound to the heavens like a baby calling for its mother. That kind of noisy grief is hopeful. It believes that things can be put right, or that help can come. There is a different kind of sound to that. Babies left alone too long do not even cry. They become very still and quiet. They know no one is coming. There have been staring eyes in the dark, but there are no shrieks now. There is no rage. The men are quiet. Over on the other side of the camp, there are still women fighting the invaders to drive them back, and there are still men picking up rocks or pieces of metal to hurt the women with. But here, those who saw it make no sound. Two of the other soldiers kick at the body of the dead man a little. They scuff dirt up over it, which might be some sign of piety or shame, but leave it there soiled and bleeding and bruised and swollen and marked with erased scars of pain, not dug into the earth at all. And they go looking for their own prizes. There is no sense in what is done here this day. There is no territory to be gained, or a particular wrong to be avenged, or even soldiers to be taken. They kill the older men in front of the younger, with palms to the faces and the throat, and one shows off her special skill of drawing crude effects upon the flesh with the tips of her fingers. Many of them take some of the men and use them or simply play with them. They offer one man a choice between keeping his arms or his legs. He chooses legs, but they break their bargain. They know that no one cares what happens here. No one is here to protect these people, and no one is concerned for them. The bodies might lie in this wood for a dozen years, and no one would come this way. They do it because they can. In the hour before dawn, they are tired. But the power coursing through them, and the powder, and the things they've done, turn their eyes red and they cannot sleep. Roxy has not moved for hours. Her limbs are sore, and her ribs grind, and her scar is yet jagged across her collarbone. She feels exhausted by what she has seen, as if the very witnessing of it had been physical labour. She hears her name called softly, and she jumps, almost unseats herself from the tree. Her nerves are so jangled and her mind so confused. Since the thing that happened, she forgets sometimes now who she is. She needs someone to remind her. She looks to her left and right, and then sees him. Two trees over. Tunde is still alive. He's lashed himself to a branch with three coils of rope, but spotting her in the pre-dawn light, he starts to untie himself. After this night, he looks like home to her, and she can tell she looks the same to him. Something familiar and secure in all of this. He climbs a little higher, where the branches meet and mingle, and hauls himself hand over hand towards her, finally dropping down softly in the little perch she's found. She's well hidden in a place where two great limbs of the tree meet, making a little nest of a thick branch that one person can rest their back on while the other leans on them. He drops down onto her. He's taken some injury she can tell in the night. He's broken something at his shoulder, and they lie heavily together. He reaches for her hand, interlaces his fingers with hers to keep them steady. They are both afraid. He smells fresh, like something green and budding. He says,
I thought you were dead, when you didn't follow me.
She says, don't speak too soon. Could still be dead tonight. He makes a little rough breath, a sign in place of a laugh. He mutters,
this also has been one of the dark places of the earth.
They both fall, dazed for a few minutes into a staring trance, a little like sleep. They should move, but the presence of a familiar body is too comforting to give up. For a moment. When they blink, there is someone in this tree, just beneath them. A woman in green fatigues, one hand in an army gauntlet, three fingers sparking as she climbs. She's shouting back down to someone on the ground. She's using her flashes to peer up through the trees, to burn the leaves. It's still dark enough that she can't see. Roxy remembers a time she and a couple of the girls heard there was a woman beating up her boyfriend in the street. It had to be stopped. You can't let that kind of thing keep on if you own a place. By the time they got there, it was just her, drunk, railing around the street, shouting and swearing. They found him, in the end, hiding in the cupboard under the stairs. And although they tried to be good and kind, Roxy thought in her heart, why didn't you fight back? Why didn't you try? You could have found a frying pan to hit her with. You could have found a spade. What good did you think hiding was going to do? And here she is, hiding, like a man. She's not sure what she is anymore. Tunde is resting on her, his eyes open, his body tense. He's seen the soldier too. He stays still. Roxy stays still. They're concealed here, even as the dawn brings on more danger. If the soldier gives up, they could be safe. The woman climbs a little higher in the tree. She's setting fire to the lower branches, though for now they flare and then smoulder out. There's been rain recently. That's lucky. One of her mates throws her up a long metal batten. They've had fun with this, inserting it and setting it crackling. She starts to sweep the upper boughs of the next tree over with this rod. No hiding place is perfect. The woman makes a swift jab. Too close to Roxy and Tunde. Too close. The tip of it ends no more than two arms' reaches away from his face. When the woman raises her hand, Roxy can smell her. The yellow scent of sweat, the acid smell of the glitter metabolizing through the skin, the peppery radish of the power itself in use. The combination as familiar as Roxy's own skin. A woman with her strength up and no ability to contain it. Tunde whispers to her,
just shock her once. It conducts both ways. When the pole comes towards us next time, grab it and shock her very hard. She'll fall to the floor. The others will have to look after her. We can get away.
Roxy shakes her head, and there are tears in her eyes. And Tunde has a sudden feeling as if his heart has opened, as if the wires around his chest have all at once unfurled. He has an idea of something. He thinks of the scar he's caught sight of at the edge of her collarbone, how protective of it she is, and how she's bargained and threatened and charmed, and yet, has he seen her? Has she ever hurt anyone in his presence since she found him in the cage? Why was she hiding in the jungle? She, a monk. She, the strongest there ever was. He had never thought of this before. He hasn't imagined for years what a woman could be without this thing, or how she could have it taken from her. The woman reaches with her rod again. The tip catches the back of Roxy's shoulder, sending an iron nail of pain into her. But she remains silent. Tunde looks around. Beneath the tree they're hiding in, there is only marshy ground. Behind them are the remains of several stomped flat tents, and three women toying with a young man who is at his very limit. Ahead, and to the right, there is the burned-out generator, and half-concealed by branches, an empty metal gasoline drum they've used as a rain collector. If it's full, it's no use to them. But it might be empty. The woman is calling back to her friends, who are shouting up words of encouragement to her. They've found someone hiding in one of the trees towards the entrance of the camp. They're looking for more. Tunde shifts position carefully. Movement will catch the soldiers' eyes, and then they'll be dead. They only need the soldiers distracted for a few minutes, just enough to get away. He reaches into his backpack, rootles his fingers through to an internal pocket, and pulls out three canisters of film. Roxy is breathing softly, watching him. She can tell from the way he's looking what he's going to try. He lets his right arm drop, like a vine detached from the tree, like nothing. He hefts the film canister in it and skims it towards the oil drum. Nothing. The throw was too short. The canister has thumped into the soft earth, dead as blood. The woman is climbing again and making those broad sweeps with a metal rod. He takes up another film canister, this one heavier than the other, and for a moment he's puzzled as to why. Then he remembers. This is the one he put his American change into, as if he'd ever use those pennies again. It almost makes him laugh. But it's good. It's heavy. It'll fly better. He has the momentary urge to bring it to his lips, like one of his uncles used to do, with a betting slip, when it was neck and neck and his whole body was tense like the racehorses on the screen. Go on, thing! Fly for me! He lets his hand dangle. He pendulums it back and forth once, twice, three times. Go on, come on, you want it! He lets it fly. The clang, when it comes, is so much louder than he'd expected. The canister had hit just at the rim. The noise means the vessel cannot be full of water. It is wild. The oil drum reverberates. It sounds intentional, like someone announcing their arrival. Heads turn across the camp. Now, quickly he does it again. Another canister, this one packed with matches against the wet. Heavy enough, another wild gong. Now it seems like there must be someone there, someone making a stand, some idiot calling the hurricane to descend on her. They come, quick, from around the camp. Roxy has time to pull a thick stump of branch off the tree, hurling it towards the oil drum to make one more bang and shout of metal before they're close enough to see what's happening. The woman who was so nearly on her scrambles down through the branches of the tree in her rush to be the first to pull up whichever fool it is who thought they could stand against these forces. Tunde's whole body is aching now. There is no differentiation between the sources of pain, the cramp and the broken bones, and there's little enough space between him and Roxy that when he looks down, he can see her wound and scarring, and it hurts him as if the line had been cut along his own body. He stretches himself by the arms, feeling with his feet for the broad lower branch, runs along it. Roxy's doing the same. They drop down, hoping that the cover is enough to hide the shape of movement from the women in the camp. Stumbling through the marshy earth, Tunde risks one single look back, and Roxy follows his gaze to see if the soldiers have tired of the empty oil drum now, to see if they are after them. They're not. The drum wasn't empty. The soldiers are kicking it, and laughing, and reaching in to lift out the contents. Tunde sees, and Roxy sees, as if in a camera's flash, what they have found. There were two children in the oil drum. They're lifting them out. They are perhaps 5 or 6. They are sobbing, still curled tight into balls as they are lifted up. Tiny soft animals trying to protect themselves. A pair of blue trousers frayed at the bottom. Bare feet. A sundress spotted with yellow daisies. If Roxy had her power, she would return and turn every one of these women all to ash. As it is, Tunde grabs her hand and pulls her away, and they run on. Those children would never have survived. They might. They would have died there anyway of cold and exposure. They might have lived. It is a cold dawn, and they run hand in hand, unwilling to let one another go. She knows the way of the land and the safest roads, and he knows how to find a quiet place to hide. They keep running until they can only walk, and still they walk on, mile after mile, in silence, palms pressed together. Towards dusk, he spots one of the deserted rail stations that populate this part of the country, waiting for Soviet trains that never came. They are mostly home to roosting birds now. They smash a window to pile in, and find a few mouldy cushions on wooden benches, and in a cupboard a single dry woolen blanket. They dare not make a fire, but they share the blanket, together, in a corner of the room. He says, "I've done a terrible thing." And she says, "You've saved my life." She says, "You can't even believe half the things I've done, mate. Bad, bad things." And he says, "And you saved my life." In the dark of the night, he tells her about Nina and how she published his words and his photographs under her name, and how he knows by that she was always waiting to take from him everything he had. And she tells him about Daryl and what was taken from her. And in that telling, he knows everything. Why she carries herself like this, and why she's been hiding all these long weeks, and why she thinks she can't go home, and why she hasn't struck against Daryl at once and with great fury, as a monk would do. She had half forgotten her own name until he reminded her of it. One of them says, "Why did they do it, Nina and Daryl?" And the other answers, "Because they could." That is the only answer there ever is. She holds his wrist, and he is not afraid. She runs her thumb along the palm of his hand. She says, "The way I see it, I'm dead, and so are you. What do dead people do for fun around here?" They are both injured and hurting. His collarbone, he thinks, is broken. There is a grinding pain in it every time he shifts position. Theoretically, he is stronger than her now. But this makes them both laugh. She is short and stocky like her dad, the same thick bull's neck, and she has fought more than him. She knows the ways of fighting. When he plays at pushing her back onto the ground, she plays at putting her thumb on the centre of his pain, where the shoulder joins the neck. She presses just enough to make him see stars. He laughs, and she laughs, breathless and foolish in the middle of the storm. Their bodies have been rewritten by suffering. They have no fight left. They cannot in that moment tell which of them is supposed to be which. They are ready to begin. They move slowly. They keep their clothes half on. She traces the line of an old scar at his waist. He took it in Delhi when he first learned fear. He touches his lips to the livid line at her collarbone. They lie, side by side. After what they've seen, they cannot want it fast or hard now. Either of them. They touch one another gently, feeling out the places where they are alike and where they are different. He shows her he is ready, and she is ready too. They slide together simply, key in a lock. "Ah," he says. "Yes," she says. "It's good. Her around him. Him inside her. They fit. They move slowly and easily, taking account of each other's particular pains, smiling and sleepy, and for a moment, without fear. They come with soft, animal grunts, snuffling into each other's necks, and fall asleep like that, legs intertwined underneath a found blanket in the center of a wall.